honorable members and colleagues. Thank you very much. I think just a couple of introductory remarks. First is that Minister Gordhan is also attending to cabinet business, so he also conveys his apologies. The second point is just to make the general remark that we profoundly appreciate the work that is being done by the Portfolio Committee. Much as we as a Ministry of Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs and the Department of Cooperative Governance in particular has a constitutional and a statutory duty to monitor and to exercise oversight over the functioning of provinces and municipalities in particular, and it's something that we are doing in a progressively sharper and more focused way through the back to ICT approach. We ourselves appreciate the oversight function that is being played by this committee. And I think particularly for those of us in the executive, much as we exercise or try to exercise oversight over the departments that we've been appointed to, it always helps to have extra eyes and extra ears in that task. So I think we just want to thank you for your ongoing questions, proposals, and I think the last BRR, BRRR session that we had, I think the committee was exercising that oversight function in a very, very constructive way, and we appreciate it very much. So we're very happy then to be back here today to come and deliver on what it was said that we are owing. We don't like to be in debt, and we certainly wouldn't want to end up on the with the Parliamentary Credit Bureau for outstanding debt. So, Didi Madonsela and Dr. Phillips will then do two presentations. We ask that they do those presentations consecutively, and that we then open up to engagement. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Deputy Minister. Now, please take us from.
Thank you very much, Chairperson and honorable members. Good morning, colleagues. I will take you through this presentation fairly quickly. Let me just state up front that this presentation is supported by narrative reports. We'll speak in a bit more detail about the matters that are covered in this presentation. So to that extent, I propose not to be too detailed in what I present, because the detail of it is already set out in the narratives that we have already provided to members of the committee. The outline of our presentation is set out in slide number 2, which covers the progress report on the committee's recommendations in 2014, and we will cover items 2.1 to 2.4, but we'll also then cover matters relating to the demarcation transition grants, and then report on the municipal forensic reports, and then make some observations and recommendations for the committee perhaps to deliberate on. I'm using a very unusual machine this morning, Chairperson. Upfront, we would like to just indicate to the committee that the department has made significant strides in implementing the recommendations of the committee as set out in the BRRR 2014. Mm. And as I said, we will be covering these matters relating to the issues that have been specifically raised. What we'll do, because in the BRRR 2014, there were matters relating to the equitable share that were raised under that. We'll also then couple that with matters relating to what measures have been put in place to support municipalities that were facing the prospect of the equitable share being withheld. On slide number 5, we then specifically talk about the equitable share formula. And in this slide, we really cover the fact that the equitable share is in a sense a resources that have been collected and were directed in terms of section 214 and 217 of the Constitution as to how that money is in a sense to be shared across the 6 spheres of government, and that the share that goes to local government then spreads across the 278 municipalities. The local government equitable share has had to be revised in that the formula of it has been found to be lacking in that it hasn't kept pace with the developments. And in 2012 then, there was a consultative process that involved the National Treasury, ourselves, the South African Local Government Association and the Financial and Fiscal Commission, together with the with FSA. We looked at, of course, including other stakeholders in local government, we looked at the desirability or otherwise to improve on this formula, to enable it to, in a sense, give us an equitable share that responds to the needs of municipalities at present. The formula was in fact revised in 2013. What stands out very clearly as a new component in that formula is the inclusion of what is called community services or non-tradable services, and this would include things like fire services, health services, and the like. These are matters that were historically underpinned in how the equitable share formula was being worked out. As one of the members will know, the equitable share focuses on essentially a number of services that would include services to poor households. It would also cover institutional arrangements of municipalities and all matters that are important for the well-functioning of the municipality and its ability to render services, especially to the poorer section of our communities. So the details of the changes to the formula and will be shared, and some of that is already set out in the narrative documents, but perhaps in the question and answer session we can provide more detail to the committee. Now this brings us to slide number 6, which talks about the withholding of the or the late transfer of the equitable share to affected municipalities. All our members will know that there were municipalities, 59 of them, which were significantly indebted to Eskom and the water boards, and that the National Treasury engaged with these municipalities with a view to getting them to make specific arrangements with both the water board and Eskom with regard to the repayment arrangements in respect of those municipalities that were not in a position to immediately settle the debts that was owing to either to either Eskom or the water boards. As you will see in the next slide, which is where we give some detail on these engagements that have been held with municipalities. Municipalities are given an opportunity until the 13th of March 2015 to finalize arrangements with Eskom or Water Board, alternatively to settle those debts immediately. And there was an extra step required of each municipality that was so affected that there ought to be a council resolution, in a sense, acknowledging the indebtedness of the municipality to pave the way for those who are responsible for the public affairs in those municipalities to then honour the obligations in terms of the arrangement that would be made. It was also indicated that if municipalities did not comply with one of those conditions set out under point one on slide number seven, that such equitable share allocations will be withheld effective March of 2015. We had, as I said, 59 municipalities that were so affected, and 49 of them owed Eskom the largest amounts, and 10 municipalities were also owing the largest amounts to the water boards. So then a total of 58 municipalities have in fact received their full equitable share tranches for March 2015. This was consequent to them having entered into repayment arrangements with Eskom and the water boards. Only one municipality, known as Rønnestadburg, did not receive any funding at all because they could not enter into the arrangement that was required with Eskom in particular. So an amount of 2.08 billion of the equitable share of the 2.08 billion that would otherwise have been held, 2.04 billion has in fact been released, which means that a small amount remained unreleased to specifically the Rønnestadburg local municipality for the reasons I've already indicated. But that wasn't necessarily seen at the end of the road, in that municipalities did require some assistance to enable them to, in a sense, comply with the agreement that they were about to sign with the government. So SALCA and the National Treasury were involved in negotiating and signing of the agreements between Eskom and the affected municipalities. So it was then agreed, based on the agreement already made, that municipalities would then be required to stick to this agreement, and that failure to live up to the agreements already made would attract the invocation of Section 216 of the Constitution by the National Treasury, which effectively means that monies would not then be transferred to the municipalities, but that the Treasury would then manage those resources on behalf of the municipality, especially in those instances where there's been a persistent breach by municipalities of the agreements already reached with Eskom and the water board. So we then move on to item 2.3, which talks about the municipal infrastructure grant. In this regard, Chairperson, we would like to inform the committee that historically, our monitoring of the municipal infrastructure grant has been by way of receiving reports from municipalities based on the projects that have been approved for funding under the Municipal Infrastructure Grant Program. But very often we monitor the expenditure on our MIS, which is Management Information System. But the rate of expenditure did not always correspond to the level of rollout of infrastructure projects, which then meant that we needed extra measures to make sure that the expenditure we see is in fact related to actual infrastructure rollout on the ground. So since 2014, the Treasury allocated us additional resources to employ staff that would physically conduct surveys and, where possible, even take pictures of infrastructure that's being rolled out, whether it be a road or sanitation projects and the like. And not only will we have a written report of what people have seen in order to verify whether it affects the expenditure already incurred and the need corresponds with infrastructure on the ground. So that has improved our ability to follow the rent, in a sense. And we are very grateful to the Treasury for having come to the party in this regard. And at the same time, we are then updating our MIS, MIS, to strengthen the monitoring as a means of our incremental improvements into the future on how the quality of information that we collect can be found useful both ourselves and the institutions that we account to, including this portfolio committee. So slide number 10 indicates the expenditure as at end of September 2015. the first block on the upper left indicates the provinces, and the first block after that, or rather the second block, then indicates the funds that have been allocated, that is for the year, and then what follows is an indication of how much money of the total that has been allocated, so it has in fact been transferred to municipalities within that province. And let me just take minutes of the committee to the third last column, which then talks about the expenditure as a percentage of the total allocation, and then the second last then indicates the expenditure as a percentage of what has been transferred already. So in a sense, this is a quarter report, which starts from the beginning of the municipal financial year in July of 2015. And the last column then indicates what has been unspent, not of the total allocation, but of what has been transferred to municipalities. And we see there that of what has been transferred, we only have about 2.6 billion rands, which in a sense represents a total of about 6% of total allocation to all municipalities across the country. It certainly indicates that as a quarterly performance for municipalities, a lot more needs to be done. Because the expectation is that they would have, in that quarter, expended a significant amount on the infrastructure rollout. The next slide, Chairperson, then deals with the application of the SMART principle, which is a matter that was raised very sharply in the 2014 BRRR. But also 2 weeks ago when we met with the committee, the matter was raised again very sharply. In this regard, Jefferson, we would like to report that a lot of effort has been put on ensuring that our performance indicators, especially those that we as a part and the entities that are associated with us, actually do comply with the SMART principle. We have in fact been asked to make sure by the committee that our indicators do comply with the SMART principles, and that we need to engage with the Auditor General to reach consensus on exactly how the work that we do is going to be measured in terms of both indicators and targets. In slide number 12, we then indicate there, Jefferson, that we have in fact engaged with the Auditor General, and we have discussed these matters in order to try and find common ground. And as we did indicate 2 weeks ago, I think the most contentious aspect relates to the issue of support, in that we then needed to reach agreement with the Auditor General on what is the nature of support that must be given. So it's not good enough, as the AG says, that we should state the fact that we'll be supporting the municipality. We need to drill down to what is called technical indicator description that actually points out what exactly will be done in providing support to a municipality. But what we've also done, Jefferson, is that we have set up an internal audit steering committee, which is tasked with the responsibility of working with our strategy units to improve on the management of financial and non-financial information. But also that this committee will also interact continually with the Auditor General, who are part of this committee, to make sure that we're always there's also always a meeting of minds on what is expected to ensure that we are on the right path as we continue to implement our post-audit action plan. Now, subsequent to the meeting that we held with the committee 2 weeks ago, we had a meeting with the minister where we then agreed on the plan of action that we're going to take and give effect to what the committee recommended we needed to do. We have, consistent with the view expressed by the committee, we have committed ourselves to a meeting with the Office of the Auditor General. But in the meantime, what we've also done is that we have put together a monitoring and evaluation forum, which brings everybody within the COPSA family that is involved in the area of monitoring and evaluation, to make sure that with the collective wisdom that we are putting together, and we are able to comb through our annual performance plan to make sure that our indicators meet this, the SMART principle, that our targets are indeed compliant to the SMART principle. And we are confident, based on this effort that we are putting together, Jefferson, that we should be able to live up to the expectation of the Office of the Auditor General, and that when we come to the committee next time around, we should be able to report good progress on our compliance with the SMART principle. So the forum that we have put together has already met twice. That shows a considerable level of enthusiasm to dealing with this matter at hand. So, and this, we will then use the outcomes of these consultations of this team will be used in our engagement with the Auditor General, which meeting is being arranged to take place shortly. Chairperson, on slide number 15, that's the Municipal Transition Advance. In this regard, the committee wished to know whether in fact the resources required to support the transitional arrangements leading to the 2016 local government election, especially with those municipalities whose outer boundaries have been redetermined by the Minister of Education Board, as to whether in fact there are resources being made available for this status. In this regard, Jefferson, we'd like to report that the National Department, supported by the KwaZulu-Natal Department of Corporate Development and Traditional Affairs, based on the experience the province has, have teamed up with us together with SALGA and the Financial and Fiscal Commission and the Nepal Treasury to prepare estimates of costs involved in the redetermination of municipal boundaries. And indeed, we estimated that in respect of the request that the minister made in terms of Section 22, 216 million would be required to cover costs of restructuring of human resources as well as project management of this whole process. What we can report, Chairperson, is that as of now, we have received an allocation of 139 million rands from the National Treasury as part of our 2015 to 2018 medium-term expenditure framework allocation. And of course, that there is a shortfall of 277.2 million rands in that regard, and that we have not elected. And we are now engaging further with the National Treasury, but we are also at the same time engaging with our provincial counterparts to make sure that we make up the shortfall of the 277.2 million in order to ensure the success of the transition process. Chairperson, we will stop at nothing to make sure that this money is raised, to make sure that this transition does happen between now and the election of 2016. So we have in fact we have requested the National Treasury during the 2015 adjustment estimates give us a further allocation in this regard, on the understanding that the money associated with this transition would fall under the rubric of unforeseeable and unavoidable expenditure. But indications are that the Treasury doesn't seem to believe that these things were unforeseeable. But our view, Chairperson, is that they were, because the changes that we came about in the course of the beginning of this year were in fact truly unforeseeable. What could be regarded as unforeseeable would be the transitional processes attendant to the decision already made by the board in 2013. But the decisions that were made in August, on 24th of August this year, we believe that they fall within the rubric of that particular fund. Thank you. Then, Chairperson, that leads us to a discussion on the report on municipal forensic reports. This is on slide number 19. In this regard, Chairperson, we talk here about the outcome of assessment we've made, which indicates that we have received a number of forensic reports from a number of municipalities across the country, in excess of 100, which have been commissioned by municipalities themselves in most instances into suspicious transactions and a whole range of other conduct that was deemed undesirable. Forensic reports that were commissioned in that way have in fact been shared with us. And most of these reports have made a recommendation that certain remedial or other corrective measures be taken against certain individuals within those municipalities. What we know, however, is that the outcomes of the assessment in some of these reports pointed to the need for further investigation. The forensic investigations are not in themselves conclusive as criminal investigations, especially where criminal conduct becomes apparent. What forensic reports indicate is the possibility of criminal conduct, which must now be investigated by the institutions under the criminal justice system. So, especially where the instances of fraud, corruption, and other related offenses, that these matters would be referred to law enforcement agencies. So, out of the reports that we've received from various responses across the country, nine of them were referred to the Special Investigation Unit for further assessment to determine if the cases meet the requirements to be investigated under a presidential proclamation. Because the Special Investigation Unit doesn't investigate on its own accord. There has to be a request through the Department of Justice to the President to sign a proclamation which sets out the parameters of the investigation. But there's a set of criteria that must be satisfied before the President could take that step. The other conflicting unit has already identified that there is potential for assets for future to be undertaken in respect of 18 programs in force. So in some instances, the assets for future unit is still chasing criminal dockets in order to make final decisions regarding the for future of these units. Honourable members will know that the asset for future unit doesn't only have seizure of assets as a recourse. Sometimes, where appropriate, they even ask the courts to freeze assets without necessarily having to seize them. So all those matters are part of what the asset for future unit is looking at. And so some of the cases are already being investigated by the DPCR. And we will be meeting with that team in the course of November in order to discuss the bulk of the forensic reports that we have, for them to sift through them and see whether, in fact, any of them falls within the ambit of what they can deal with. On slide number 20, we deal forensic reports assessed per province. And these are, as you can see, all provinces are on the left hand side, and the forensic reports received, that's the middle column, which is 115. But forensic reports that have been assessed to date is 106, which means that a further work still needs to be done to finalize the assessment of these forensic reports. and following the assessment of these forensic reports, letters have already been generated with recommendations and have been sent to 8 MECs across the country, requesting them to provide a progress report in respect of the recommendations set out in those forensic reports. Because some of them, as I indicated earlier on, do recommend specific remedial action to be taken, but there's no indication as to whether, in fact, such steps have indeed been undertaken. So the department is consulting with the National Prosecuting Authority with a view to requesting them to assign a dedicated team of prosecutors to focus specifically on cases of corruption and related offences that are taking place in municipalities. We believe that in so doing, first we will confirm and demonstrate the government's commitment to rooting out fraud and corruption wherever it happens, including in municipalities across the country. So, Jefferson, we believe that we have covered matters that the committee had raised with us during the 2014 BRRR, and also extra matters that the committee has expressed interest in us providing additional information there. So we recommend that the committee notes the progress report, and of course that the narrative report on the recommendations made by the control committee have also been submitted as part of the package that we have shared with the committee this morning. Thank you very much, Chairman. Now we'll hand over the lesson to Dr. Sam Phillips, who is part of the two-person relay team.
Thank you very much, DG. Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, honourable members and colleagues. We were asked to present to the committee on our post-audit action plan. And we prepared a presentation. This is our action plan that we put in place to address the audit findings in the 14-15 audit, and those findings are detailed in the Auditor General's report in MISA's annual report. And in this presentation, we've covered all the findings that are there in the Auditor General's report for that financial year in our annual report. We have also submitted to the committee a more detailed document in a spreadsheet format, where we've included other parts of our post-audit action plan, because we also have various reports from our own internal audit, and we've also included addressing the issues raised by our own internal audit in that more detailed post-audit action plan, or more comprehensive post-audit action plan. But for today, I'm going to focus on what we're doing to address the issues raised by the Auditor General in the 14-15 Auditor General report in our annual report. This slide just shows a summary of how far we are in addressing the issues. You can see from the slide that we've so far, since the audit report came out, we've addressed most of the issues, 64% of the issues. We're in the process, we've made good progress and are busy finalizing addressing another 34% of the issues. And we haven't yet made much progress, but we are starting to resolve one or two of the issues. So the one area in which the Auditor General had findings was in the area of payroll. And there are a number of issues that the Auditor General raised, including that employees continued to receive payment after resignation date, they were terminated but continued to receive payments post their termination date. If you look down on 1.2, there's more issues related to the same payroll area, such as discrepancies identified in termination dates between various data sources, employees with multiple employee numbers, and discrepancies identified between employees and employer master files. We've taken a number of actions to address this problem. Firstly, we've had a disciplinary process within MISA. As I've indicated, the various audits that we've done and our own investigations have found that two of our officials working in payroll were manipulating and defrauding the payroll system. One of them resigned when this came to light. The other official came forward voluntarily on their own and blew the whistle on his fraud and his colleague's fraud, and we had a disciplinary process in the department for that. We've laid criminal charges against both of those officials, and we provided detailed evidence to the public prosecutor to enable prosecution of those two officials. The audits we asked, the system that we're using for payroll is Sage VIP. We asked Sage VIP to do an audit as well, and the Sage VIP audit enabled us to quantify the exact amount of money that was involved in this fraud, and also to provide the necessary evidence to give to the prosecutors, and it also found that the payroll fraud was limited to the two officials concerned. We have put in place a number of management measures to stop this kind of thing from happening again. Firstly, as I'll discuss in more detail in one of the other findings later in the presentation, we put in place various management measures to improve the overall management of the training programs. This payroll fraud involves payments of stipends to trainees. MISA has about 800 trainees deployed in municipalities. And the payroll fraud was limited to the payment of the stipends to the trainees. One of the problems was that we weren't sufficiently managing the trainees on a daily basis and checking that they were at work and that they were still at work while they were getting paid, and that they didn't continue to get paid after they'd left employment. So we've addressed that issue. We've improved the management. We've improved record keeping of personal information, and we're now regularly monitoring the attendance of the trainees and linking that to payroll before payments are made. The other key control measure that we put in place is that we segregate duties between human resource and financial responsibilities to reduce the risk of that kind of fraud happening by officials working in the payroll section. And in addition to the disciplinary process and the laying of criminal charges, we've also instituted a civil claim process against the two officials to retain the money that was taken.
and he's written to him to say, pay back the money.
As correctly pointed out by the Auditor General, one of the reasons why this problem occurred was that we weren't doing sufficient risk assessments, and we are now doing risk assessments on a quarterly basis. Turning to the next area, which is expenditure management, there were findings that we hadn't taken sufficient effective steps to prevent fruitless and wasteful expenditure, which resulted in fruitless and wasteful expenditure to a value of $512,303. This relates to us not paying PAYE in time and then having to pay penalties to SARS. And we have addressed that issue. We're now making payments to third parties in the same payment run with Valerie's, thus ensuring the PAYE is paid on time. And the improved payroll control measures that I mentioned earlier also help us to stop this from happening again. We've also we've taken a number of measures to improve the monitoring of expenditure against the budget to make sure that we don't neither overspend nor underspend on our budget. We have provided financial delegations to heads of divisions within MISA so that they can have responsibility and accountability for their budget. And we've also introduced both branch or division commitment registers and a whole of MISA commitment register, and we're regularly monitoring expenditure versus the commitment register. We are also now, whenever we become aware of any criminal action, we are instituting disciplinary actions and laying criminal charges where appropriate. One of the times of, we overspent as a whole our financial year by $10.5 million, and the commitment register process that we put in place will prevent us from doing so again this financial year. There was irregular expenditure of $40.8 million identified, and that related to us going up in an open procurement tender and an open procurement process and appointing a company to help us put together the municipal infrastructure asset management system that we have, that we're providing to municipalities called Witness. The reason why it was classified as irregular expenditure is that there's a rule or a law that you're supposed to do such IT procurement through the State Information Technology Agency, or CETA, and MISA didn't do it through CETA. We've now, in future, from now on, we will ensure that we adhere to that law and that we only do our IT procurement through CETA as and when required by the regulations. One of the other findings, which is quite common across governments, is that we weren't paying our suppliers within 30 days. Over the past few weeks, I've been working with this chief financial officer and we've put in place detailed new business processes for managing the payment of invoices. And this one is classified as yellow because we still have to fully implement those business processes and monitor the implementation. Once we've done that and we are getting a record, all of our invoices being paid within 30 days, and this one will change to green. With regard to fixed assets, there were various findings, including that assets, such as that assets were not tagged properly, there were duplicate numbers, some of the assets did not have values. So there were various inconsistencies and incomplete aspects of our asset register. Those have not all been addressed, and the policy has been put in place, it's been updated, and is now maintained regularly. There were also findings with regard to human resources, particularly that we didn't have a human resource plan in place. I've mentioned to the committee before that the minister has asked us to develop a refined strategic focus for MISA, which we've done, and on the basis of that, we developed a new organizational structure for MISA, which has been submitted for approval. It requires approval of both our minister and the Minister of Public Service, and thereafter we will then develop a human resource plan with the support of human resources in the department, as we have a shared service centre for human resources with them, to fill the new structure once it's approved. That's why this one is still yellow, because we can put in place human resources plan once we've got finalisation on the new structure. Then turning to predetermined objectives, Similarly to the previous presentation, we are aware that there are weaknesses in the way in which our performance indicators and targets were formulated and in the way in which we reported progress against those performance indicators and targets. And the CFO are paying particular attention now and during this year to improve that, particularly for next year's APP. Unfortunately, there's still weaknesses with the performance indicators in the current year's APP, which we have to report against, but we want to ensure that for next year's APP, we have much better quality performance indicators and that we will no longer have findings from them on the quality and the smartness of our indicators and targets, and it will then also facilitate much better reporting against them. So all of our progress against these predetermined objective items are yellow because they'll only turn to green once we have improved indicators in next year's APP. However, we have taken measures to improve the reporting against the indicators and targets in this year's APP. Again, CFO and I are paying personal attention to the quality of the reports, and we've put in place various institutional measures within the organization to check that the reports provided by the various divisions are of adequate quality and properly supported by documentation. I think all of these slides are summarized and they cover this issue of the performance information and what we're doing about it. There were also findings related to supply chain management, such as that we did not advertise bids for the minimum period specified by trade regulations, there was no closing bid register, quotations not obtained for closed bids, no bid specification committee in place, and that we didn't properly apply the reference point system on some of the bids. We have taken measures within our supply chain management unit to ensure that now all the processes are done in terms of the regulatory frameworks. One of the problems was that while the accounting officer does in terms of the regulations have the ability to approve that the shorter that they can go out for a shorter period, the problem was that we weren't getting adequate documentation of those decisions. They need to be documented for good reasons as to why the bids are going out a shorter period, so we are now doing that properly. We have now put in place a closing bid register. And we're making sure that we follow the regulations to the T in all of the supply chain processes. We do now have all the necessary bid committees in place, properly appointed, and they are keeping proper records of their work. With regards to accounts receivables, there was a finding that other receivables balance was overstated. We've addressed that issue, debts on RAs and followed up. With regard to commitments, there was overstatement of the commitment balances, and as I mentioned, we now have a proper commitment register in place, which the CFO and myself check carefully, and we meet with management regularly to monitor expenditure versus budget. With regard to trade and other payables, there were various findings, such as it's relating to monthly credit reconciliations not being signed, no separate accounts for leave bonus and bonus provision. These are all financial matters, no differentiation between accrual and creditors. As you can see from the slide, most of them have been addressed. There's one at the top which is still yellow. We are requesting statements from suppliers on a monthly basis, but up until now we've been doing it for most of the suppliers, but not all. And the financial section has been instructed that they must do it all of the suppliers. Once that's happening, that one will change to green. There was another finding that we didn't have sufficient controls to ensure that invoices are recorded correctly. As I've indicated, we've now put in place new detailed business processes, including time frames for the different steps in the business processes for ensuring for payment of invoices, and they are now. One of those parts of the business process is that they are received at a central point and managed from a central point and monitored from a central point. So that those measures should address that problem. And that one will change to green once we regularly start paying suppliers within 30 days. Back to payroll, there was a problem that PAYE calculation was based on old tax tables. We've addressed that. some of the appointments of artisans that have our payroll located in municipalities were not signed by the CEO. We've gone through the contracts now and checked them and updated them and made sure that they're all in place, properly filed and signed. And then going back again to this problem of the terminated employees continuing to receive payments, just a bit more detail on this slide of some of the management measures we've put in place to make sure that this doesn't happen again, are that all those learners are now required to complete daily attendance registers, which must be signed off by the supervisor in the municipality. And our provincial program managers check the attendance registers and sign them off on a monthly basis as well. Our provincial program managers are also required to visit the learners on site at least quarterly to verify their presence and to check on the progress with their training. We have not been filling vacancies within the 6 month required period. As soon as our new structure is in place and we move into the recruitment process, then we'll, together with the human resources secondary department, we will endeavour to ensure we do so in future. And we are now properly managing our leave. With regard to the findings about the use of consultants, there is a treasury requirement or cabinet requirement that we should have a consultants reduction plan. We have taken that into account in the formulation of our new structure, which is awaiting approval, and that our structure includes positions in the public service for many of the people who we are now employing as consultants. And this will result in, once that's approved, it will result in a big drop in the number of consultants that we employ. While we're still employing consultants, we are now making sure that we do include requirements for experience and qualifications in the terms of reference. There were a number of findings with regard to budget, all of which have been addressed on this slide through the putting in place commitments registers, submitting our annual report of hand to Parliament. With regard to supply chain management, we've addressed most of the issues. The one thing that the auditors found that we weren't doing is to publish the bidders' names within 10 working days of closure of the bid, and that we're going to start doing now. There was also a finding that we didn't have an adequate post-audit action plan and that we weren't adequately with proper time plans and monitoring its implementation. As you can see now, we have an improved post-audit action plan, which is this presentation, with time frames, and we will be monitoring it closely. We are no longer allowing orders to be slipped through monitoring our procurement plan. And there are various findings related to our supply chain management policy. It is in the process of being reviewed. We're also reviewing it in the light of changes to the infrastructure procurement framework the Treasury is bringing into place. And we've set ourselves a target of finalizing that new supply chain management policy by the end of this month. There was a finding relating to cash and bank area, and that bank reconciliations were performed monthly and not daily. And we are now carrying out a review of the bank statement on a daily basis to monitor the transactions. Similarly, with regard to expenses, there was a finding that the suppliers were not in the contact register, and we've addressed that and now updating that register and maintaining it regularly. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Okay, so thank you very much, Dr. General and Dr. Philip. Very useful information in my view, which I said that a lot. You know exactly that recommendation that I put forward by Parliament has taken three of the 95. And I think that is a very good idea, a good way of doing things. I'm aware that sometimes the department simply look at the recommendation and simply ignore this is the behavior that the side of the recommendation. Passed by a member of parliament, including me, they are taken very
they are able to implement some of the proposals that are raised by members of parliament. I think just like this year, if I'm not mistaken, there are very few recommendations, maybe one or two. Even Anna is the most satisfied man. To satisfy Anna takes a lot of effort. He's the happiest man now that the department is doing exactly what he requests them to do. Let me invite colleagues who want to comment. Honorable Samoa, as long as Samoa, you want to find the minister in the chamber today. he was going for Honorable Zulu yesterday. For no apparent reason, the angry young man. And then he blasted the minister. I thought the parliamentary security services should enter the room and take you out. Honorable Samoa, Maham, Petra.
No, thank you very much, Honorable Chair, Honorable Deputy Ministers, colleagues, and Coptor family present. Good morning. Chair, I think I just have one or two things. The first one refers to the DG. Under Section 22, the determinations which were a transition. I don't think I'm in agreement with it being unforeseeable. I'm not in agreement with it. Because I agree with the notion that we must ensure that ministers are viable. My only issue is the timing at which the Section 22 was invoked, which I don't believe the ripple effect of it became what I would call the escalated cost. And so, of course, that then being the case, you know, it's in a shortfall of 277 million. And I would want to, whilst the DG says that engagements are ongoing, trade, national treasury and provinces are just a shortfall, at what stage are those engagements? Because I believe that with the elections almost now 9 months at most away, and maybe the tranche, the full figure, 460 million. How has that been broken down? What is needed in the short term, medium term, and long term of this transition in the midst of these researches? But I don't think we can, in good faith, say it was unforeseeable when the Section 22 was invoked, which we knew then that it would have, to a certain extent, financial implications. But I take the point that a rival municipality and intervention is required, but the timing of it, as far as I'm concerned, was a problem. Chair, I'm going to go to the MISA presentation and say that as a person who serves on SOPA, I honestly want to say that this support is a breath of fresh air. You must be honest about that. Of course, a situation where departments and entities just don't want to respond positively to what the AG addresses, and it becomes an issue. And I think that the effort that has been put in place, that has been presented to us, where line item by line item and action plan has been determined, is commendable. Because I think really the work of the AG is to make sure that corrections are done. It's not to penalize anybody. And so I know that at SOPA we were contemplating calling MISA to a hearing because we were concerned really about the extent to which I think that the action plan that has been presented and the fact that we understand that MISA was new and so there would be these establishment glitches. But I do want to say that we would probably need progress reports, particularly on areas where the criminal charges have been laid. And then to say generally, Chair, what seems to be a problem in departments and entities is the failure to comply with TSMA and National Treasury Regulations and internal audits and the month-to-month and quarter-on-quarter audits.
I think we will need to place a greater emphasis, a greater focus on that, understanding the complex nature in which NISA is structured. It will need to become a priority so that we do not have these issues. And I think we will say it would be in the interest of NISA and the committee to be captured first in terms of the phases of the implementation of this, and then judge that progress, not when the audit outcome come out at the end, but the social reporting is going to become very important. But here I felt I should really commend the fact that the action plan speaks to the issues and that consequences which are lacking in many departments are being instituted. Because if you're going to fund a public fund, you must walk the plank. We shouldn't be covering for each other, so I commend the chair this action.
Thank you, Chairperson, and firstly let me apologize for arriving late. Chairperson, I want to agree with Honourable Tengwa. The report is indeed a breath of fresh air from NISA, and I have just one question on that report, and that is the status and effectiveness of NISA's internal audit function. Is it established? Is it operational? Are they providing input onto these matters? And are they assisting in addressing these concerns? Then, Chair, with regard to the report from the Director General, I have a lot of questions, so if I may, it's going to take a few minutes. My first question relates to the equitable share. In the narrative report, and indeed in slide presentations, the DG refers to the fact that the new formula is based on an estimate of population in each municipality on an annual basis. So my question is, how is that estimate calculated? And why do we not use statistically valid figures? For example, every municipality every year goes through the non-financial audit by Statistics South Africa. That's presented in Parliament in August, September, and it gives us a statistical base on which we could determine the equitable share. So my question is, why not use that as a baseline research? Then, Chair, with regard to the withholding of equitable share, I note that Rensburg is the only municipality that has not received its equitable share funding, and yet the reason that's given for that withholding for Rensburg is that they haven't signed an agreement with Eskom. But if we go through the report, we know that there are two other municipalities who are not named who also haven't signed agreements with Eskom or with the water boards, and yet no action has been taken against them. So my question is, why is Rensburg singled out? One, and two, why has no action been taken against the other two municipalities with regard to withholding their equitable share? Then when does the department anticipate that these issues of signing these agreements with municipalities, when will they be resolved? What is the time frame that you're working to in that regard? In the narrative report, you talk about having had a meeting with Eskom to address some of the issues in September. But there's no indication as to what the outcome of that meeting is. Now, the two major issues that municipalities have with Eskom are, one, the exorbitant interest rate that gets charged, and two, the 15-day payment requirement. And we've heard that again and again in committee meetings from Selga, from municipalities, etc. So what were the outcomes of that meeting? Did any progress get made in that regard? Or is Eskom being hot-headed and saying, this is the way it is and the way it's going to be. So then referring to the MIG report, if I may, I'm just going to pull up the narrative report here. There's a detailed breakdown of every province's MIG transfers to the municipalities. And what worries me is that a number of municipalities, no funds have actually been transferred as yet to the municipalities. So, for example, in the Eastern Cape, Makana has an allocation of 23 million and nothing transferred. In Limpopo, Tabazimbi has an allocation of 29 million, zero transferred. And then in the Western Cape, Northern Cape, Ubuntu, 9 million, zero transferred. Telalise, 9 million, zero transferred. Transabani, 15 million, zero transferred. Makgabeng, nearly 11 million, zero transferred. and I think it's Samakara, 11 Nyeri Tolman, 0 Thompson. Now, we're expecting these municipalities to expend funds, but the provincial departments are not transferring the funds to them. And that's reflecting on your overall report, where you say, in the province, 38% of MIG funding has been spent. I'd like to know why those municipalities have not received their MIG funding that has been allocated to them. Chair, then on forensic reports, the DG spoke to the steps that the department is taking. I have heard that a number of these reports have prescribed. In other words, the charges have become outdated. They no longer can be enforced, or the allegations can no longer be enforced. Is that correct? And if so, why has it taken so long for these issues to be addressed? Then the second question is, what action is the department taking to ensure that councils actually act upon forensic reports? Because again and again, and the real reason why the department has been asked to take over the assessment and actions on these forensic reports is because the councils are not acting. So what are you putting in place, or what mechanisms are you implementing to ensure that when a forensic report is initiated, the council then takes action on that report? Chairperson, turning to the transitional grant, I agree with Honourable Flengler that it was not unforeseeable. In fact, the Minister issued the Section 22 notice the first time on the 12th of December last year. The budget was approved in February of this year, and yet nothing was mentioned at that time of a shortfall. In fact, I raised as a concern in the budget debate, I raised in committee that this money, and no one said that there was a shortfall. It's now come out that there's a shortfall of 277 million rand. So I don't agree that it was unforeseeable. In fact, I raised it personally, so I know it wasn't unforeseeable. But my question on this one is, you've allocated a fixed cost to each municipality. For example, you said 7.2 million for each merger for restructuring costs, 10 million for human resource costs, 5 million for each affected province for project management costs. How do you get to those figures? Surely some municipalities are going to incur more costs than others. I mean, in some cases, and I look, for example, the Kamdevoer Bavi Anthony Kwezi merger. It's going to create the second biggest municipality in South Africa in terms of geographic area. It's three municipalities that have vastly divergent systems and structures and staffing levels and staffing remuneration and so on and so forth. Surely that's going to require more than the amalgamation, for argument's sake, of Nyuva and Nkonkobe. So how do we get to a fixed cost of 7.2 million and 10 million? Chair, then my last question relates to the debts that are owed to municipalities. If I have a look at the report, and I just added up the numbers very quickly, municipalities are owed 4.3 billion rand by national and provincial government, by departments of national and provincial government. We have raised this as a concern before, and it doesn't seem that there is, you know, if I can just find it here, it doesn't seem as if there's any real measure being taken to kill that. To enforce payment to municipalities. The provincial and national departments are basically saying, oh, well, you know what, we can pay them later. Now, I know the PFMA makes provision for a 30-day payment cycle, but no one is holding those departments to account for their non-payment. What steps are being taken to ensure that municipalities receive the funds that are due to them? Because this is contributing to non-viable municipalities. This is contributing to municipalities that are unable to pay their debt to Eskom and water boards. And in turn, we end up in a vicious cycle because then there's the holding of equitable share and. So what is the department doing to actually make sure that other departments are paying their bills. Thank you, Jeff.
No, thanks, Chair. Indeed, Chair, this is a good report, particularly from the MISA side. There is a turning in the corner there. But there are still few issues that was not really adequately covered. The first one, Chair, you remember that the AG was complaining mostly about the systems in the department. That the systems, there's a lack of system in the department, especially in the appointment of artisans and the temporary employees. In that area, the AG had emphasized even further indicated the lack of leadership in that area. So we would love to see that being addressed adequately. And also, Chair, the issue of appointment of contractors. It was also indicated that other contractors did not have even proper qualification that was supposed to be in the department. That one, Chair, as well, the matter that need to be monitored very close in the report. The other issue of the withholding of the funds, and it has been addressed, but my issue was to ask if, particularly to my concerner, to the community, that how many of this municipality, besides the one that we have got, that have still not got their funds, and also are in crisis in terms of the payment of escrow. And lastly, Chair, the figures that he has shared with us in terms of the shortage, you talk about 277, but in the paper he has presented is 292.4, which is the right figure. And the others is 431.4 million, which is the really right figure, because in your presentation you talk about 277.2, on the other one, and the cost, you talk about 431.4 million. So we may be clarified in terms of the correct figure. Thanks, Chair.
Well, requested from us as Parliament that in October last year that a report will be finalized, and in this report of a forensic audit will be finalized in March. Mm-hmm. Then in March he requested an extension to June. Last week, if we did not we were not going to receive a report. The first question, why in the request of the extension by June that we did not receive this report? Because if we could have forgotten members of Parliament that have asked this report, we could not have been having this kind of report in front of us. I'm asking this because I'm going to ask certain questions, like in the report, it is reported that they are interaction with the NPA. What kind of interactions are those? I want to understand. It might be a consultation. If you say consultation, you might have written a letter. Or this consultation you're referring to, DG, are they now on an advanced level that we're going to see action being taken by the NPA? Because to me, that does not answer my question. Again, in the report, you mentioned the SIU, that the president should make a promulgation. How far we? It's just a written a letter, or at the level of the executive, that this has been escalated to that level to understand that action has been taken. Because now we're talking about a year, or in other reports, as Kevin was saying, like Abuso, from the finished 10 years. And if we're still talking about writing letters to people, not escalating those things to the level of people where I can take decisions. It might as well look as if I'm not doing anything, it's the same thing. Because one action, not necessarily zero. But let me say I'm happy with the report that it's been compiled. But I want to check maybe to the executive. Because if there's action like this, to me it's not about us sitting here in this closed world here and talk about that we're going to take action about people who are doing things in government. It's also for the people to know that government is trying to take action. Whether are we going to announce this report publicly when we have compiled it completely to say, look, this is what we're doing in government. We are after those who are stealing from our people. Because as long as they don't know out there that we are after them, it's like we're not doing anything. I don't want people to steal money and then we go after them. I want people not to steal from the masses of our people. Therefore, I want to announce this publicly, the actions we are going to take and what we have done so far. If you are not, I want to recommend that you must announce this work that you are doing here publicly, because the public wants to know that we are doing something about it. The other issue I think you raised very importantly, Minister, in which we were talking about last week, is the issue of our oversight. We raised an issue about doing oversight over provinces. And I like the fact that we have also raised that aspect. But we know that we don't need permission from the executive. But I want to agree that we wanted to do and we're doing consultation. I hope we're going to get the board, because we requested last week that there must be an opinion in relation to our ability to call in provinces and during the annual reporting for us to do our proper oversight, in which with my narrow understanding of some few things, but I think this is our responsibility also to do oversight over provinces. Therefore, I think that sentiment you've expressed, I like it. Lastly, I think I'm going to raise this to you. We can celebrate the fact that we the progress in relation to this NISA report, but it does surprise me, you know, that we could live with people for years who are supposed to be doing this work on a daily basis, looking after payroll, auditing of an institution, payment of suppliers. They go to work, they earn millions, they even earn more than us. Millions and millions of us, they go to work and don't do their work there when they go to work. And at the level of senior management, it tells me that you have senior managers who don't necessarily do their monitoring and the work that they're supposed to do. When I was in agriculture, I used to say that if we're not in constitutional democracy, we'll just arrest every senior manager, put in a van, like in old days, in a hippo, put them at the back and put them in prison. Because they're not doing the work that they're supposed to do on a daily basis. Meaning a person who's supposed to sign a check does not go to sign a check. And it takes 10 years to go after them. And that's wrong. Because not only the issue of politicians, it's the issue of senior management managers who do the amount of tournament. Now we're celebrating the progress. We've done good progress. Yes, progress was done, but how long have we took to do progress? Therefore, at least we must be able to take action, Minister, timeously and deal with people that we are supposed to deal with. I want to suggest, DG, on the link, expenditure monitoring. You make a very good example that you will be going to projects, for instance, two photos, you are able to identify that this project is happening. I know to have had a system at another level where you can even go to their website and see how projects run. And to have in the old days, I do 5 years, the same is back when I was doing the M&E. Are we going towards that direction? That is, in ourselves, can just go to a website or MIC or MISA and then be able to punch in and say, look, these are the projects that are in place, and go and trace them in terms of progress. Therefore, I want to suggest, if you are not doing that,
you consider also doing that for us to have also as South Africans a broader access to be able to do a proper monitoring on what is happening on the ground. Thank you.
Okay, now thank you very much, Honorable Banga. Dr. Phillips and DG, you can assist you to Deputy Minister.
No, Chair, I think DG Madonsela and Dr. Phillips will deal with many of the matters that have been raised in relation to their respective inputs. But I think just to make a couple of general points. I think, again, to underscore the issue of oversight and the importance of oversight. When it comes to the issue of oversight, I think we all need to be clear. There's not an adversarial relationship between ourselves and the committee. We view this as a collective and a joint enterprise because collectively we are committed to serving South Africa's people and to be using the resources that we're given to do so in a responsible and an accountable way. So again, we want to express our indebtedness to the committee for the questions that you raised. I mean, it keeps us on our toes. It helped us to push and to constantly improve, and I think results of that were seen here today. With regard to oversight over provinces, I think that is an important area that we as a DCOG recognize that we perhaps haven't paid as much attention to as we should. But I think just to maybe sound a couple of words of caution to say that as a portfolio committee, I'm sure that no doubt you would be engaging your counterparts in the NCOP with regards to matters relating to provinces. And of course, when we talk about oversight over provinces, we're also talking about oversight over a system, a provincial system, a system of intergovernmental relations. The second broad point is that with regards to the fight against fraud and corruption. I think we've made it very, very clear repeatedly, both in this committee, in parliamentary debates, in our public pronouncements, that we as a department, both internally, that we have a zero tolerance policy towards fraud and corruption. Internally, and also in relation to municipalities. And I think that is why Minister Gordhan took the initiative to get all provinces to report on forensic investigations that have been done. I think also just to underscore the point that it doesn't stop with that, that whenever there are allegations of malfeasance in any municipality, the minister uses the powers in Section 106 to request the relevant MECs to investigate and to report. So this is ongoing work. I can't agree more with the Honourable Banga that these good things need to be communicated widely and effectively. We welcome his offer to act as a COCT spokesperson. We will encourage him and supply him with everything that he needs. But on a serious note, just to say that it's not the first time that we've spoken publicly about these things. I think both in parliamentary questions, in debates in the House and on other fora, we've announced that we've spoken about these things and the forensic reports issue often. The third issue is with regard to the transition, the transitional grant. Now, I think just to start off by saying that The college at National Treasury are indeed blessed and gifted with the spectacles that afford in both foresight and hindsight. Regrettably, not all of us go to the same optometrists. I think we just need to bear in mind the following, and DG Marcella can correct me if I'm wrong. If I could recall correctly, the issue of the request to the Demarcation Board to examine the redemarcation in view of the viability or non-viability was first broached at a MNMEC in December of 2014. The actual Section 22 notices were only issued in January of 2015. Now, the budget was tabled in the second or third week of February. I think we all know how the budget cycle and processes work, but you don't come to National Treasury a week beforehand and put something down. I mean, essentially, budgets get closed, DG, what, around November? Yes. Yeah, so by then the door is long closed. The second issue there, of course, and I want to underscore this in view of the fact that there is a particular party to which members in this room belong who have gone to court to contest the findings and the determinations of the Demarcation Board. One of the issues that they raised very strongly in their legal challenge was the allegation that the board was not acting independently, that it was basically acting at the behest of the minister. Now, unless the members are saying that the minister by some means should have known exactly what the board was going to decide in July of 2015, 4 or 5 months after the budget, the national budget was announced, I don't quite see how it could then, this matter could have been entirely foreseeable. It would be foreseeable that certain costs might arise, but the true extent of those costs could surely only have been known once the board had made its determination, unless it was being suggested that the minister somehow had some undue influence and knew in advance what the board would have decided. But we take the view that the board is an independent entity and it takes its decisions after considering the factors spelled out in the Demarcation Act and engaging the public. So we do maintain the view that those expenses, whilst foreseeable that they might arise. We had no way at that stage of quantifying the extent of the amount. DG and Dr. Phillips.
Thank you very much, Minister. I think you dealt with some of the more difficult questions. I'm indebted to you for that, Dean. Honourable Member Sangwa raised the question regarding the consensual arrangements, and in fact he wanted to know how far, at what stage are we in our engagements with the Treasury. We now know, after the adjustment estimates, or the adjusted estimates were presented, that indeed we're not going to get any allocation. We did not get any allocation out of the adjustment process. The only option available to us now, which is the engagements we are pursuing with the Treasury, is our E&E allocations, which will be coming in November. And that's where we're engaging with them over now, to see whether, in our new allocations, the Treasury will then take into account the fact that there is a shortfall that would need to be met. Because these are costs that definitely can only be met out of the proficiency. So that is essentially what we are pinning our hopes on at this point, in addition to the other measures that we outlined, that we are also engaging with our provincial counterparts to see whether they would be able to pitch in to assist in defraying costs of the transition. I do not wish to take further the debate about whether or not the resources required were foreseeable or not. I think the DM has put into that point quite exhaustively. Honourable Member Millham asked a question regarding the equitable share, specifically asking whether if estimate of population is an important consideration, why do we not use STEP as data as baseline? I think that has already been done, Honourable Member. The trouble we face is that population size has changed quite rapidly, and our census only happens once in almost 5 years, and once that has happened, you'll find that in fact there are various changes that take place in municipalities. Municipal boundaries change, population sizes in each municipality also get impacted upon in particular ways. There's a very rapid migration in the country, from the countryside in the main to the urban centre. And that tends to impact on population trends and population size in its municipality. So those are factors that are taken into account. And STEP as a, from time to time, also do what is called general household survey, which are done in between the census. And that kind of information also gets taken into account. To the extent that there are shortfalls with respect to data, then you would have to find other ways of making sure that if you estimate what population it is that is going to be serviced by a municipality in order to determine what equitable share they will get in order to support that, that population. And as I said, specifically with regard to the provision of services to the poor, which forms part of the equitable share. If the poor move as they do as part of the migration from the countryside to the urban centres, that distortion that comes with where they were at one time and where they happen to be at the time when an equitable share is allocated is an important factor to take into account. But our resident expert on the subject, Mr. Sugidi, will perhaps simplify the points much clearer. And I think he will also deal with the issues relating to other municipalities other than, or municipalities other than Rostocker, whose equitable share allocations were not withheld. And he'll be able to assist us with that. On the matters relating to the meeting with ESCOM and what the outcomes were, Mrs. Giddy will also assist us with that. On the MIG report, the Honourable Member has requested a detailed breakdown of transfers to municipalities. I think that information can be made available. I don't know if Mr. Kiddy has that information readily available on the municipalities where nothing has been transferred, like Makana and several others that the only member referred to. On the forensic reports, Honourable Miriam makes the point that some charges have been scrapped. I can't speak with authority on this point, seeing that I ceased practicing law several years ago. But once it is possible for a civil claim to prescribe, I'm not sure whether a crime to thus prescribe that system. If I made yourself guilty of criminal conduct, you can be arrested many years later. I've never heard of an instance where a crime actually prescribed. It could be that I misunderstood the point that the Honourable Member was making.
but I'm not aware of any charges that was actually prescribed, especially if they are criminal. But instances may arise where if there is misconduct which must be dealt with through the labor relations process, if it's not dealt with timely, an issue can be raised about the length of time it has taken for charges to be prepared. But I'm not sure whether the Honourable Member is referring to criminal charges or disciplinary charges in this instance. But the Honourable Member will ask the question, what steps are being taken to ensure that municipal councils implement what is said in the forensic reports? The Deputy Minister spoke about the fact that the Minister in fact took the initiative to request all municipalities to submit to us copies of those forensic reports, precisely because we wanted to know what is it that municipalities were doing with these reports. And having established that in some instances where specific remedial action was recommended, that no such action was taken, we have in fact written to the MECs, as we are required by law to do, to request the MECs in terms of Section 106, I think, of the Systems Act, to make follow-up with the municipalities that fall within the jurisdiction of that MEC to make sure that they follow through on those actions. And we have written, the Minister has written to the MECs to make sure that there are clear recommendations as to remedial action or corrective action, that those effects are followed through. And that we will continue to engage with MECs to make sure that there is follow-up, even in instances where we have received reports which indicate that some steps are being taken. We will not relent in making sure that indeed such action is followed through to the very end. On matters relating to the transitional grant, I have already pointed out that the matter will not be taken any further, and that we are pinning our hopes on other processes that I've already indicated. There was a question raised about the fixed costs. I don't know whether you'll be able to ask. Dr. Anahela will be able to speak directly on the issue of the fixed cost of 7.2 and 10 million in relation to the transition. Dr. Anahela will assist us with specific details on that. On matters relating to debt owing to municipalities, we've been specifically asked to indicate what measures are being taken to enforce payments by national and provincial government departments to municipalities. I'm sure we have reported before to this committee that there is a team put together which involves both ourselves and the National Department of Public Works, whose responsibility it is to make sure that where there have been queries, especially with regard to the invoices, that these invoices appear. Because in many instances, what we've been told by national and provincial departments, that wrong invoices were sent to them, or alternatively, that there were queries with regard to what they were invoiced for. There was, in fact, in the course of last year, and I hope I'm right, and a service provider appointed by the Department of Public Works to look through the invoices that were being contested by national and provincial departments. And in that, significant progress was made in whittling down the numbers of concerns that have been raised by national and provincial departments. And in fact, we saw a significant reduction of the figure that was owing to municipalities by national and provincial departments. I don't have that information on my fingertips. I know that this figure of 4.3 billion was applicable at some point, but I don't know if it remains the same. No, I'm not looking at that. But now I'm looking at focusing on the question that's been posed. I think Mr. Sikiri would also
be able to update us further on this, because the issue relating to what National and Provincial Departments are owing to the municipalities, the Honourable Member is quite correct, that it is important for us to make sure that National and Provincial Departments do pay what is due and payable to the municipalities in order to enable them to pay what they owe to our investors. So that's certainly taken. Honourable Member Mseka raised the question about the shortfall. What is exactly? Is it 292.4 or is it 277.2? I think there was an error in the initial calculation, and we tried to correct the figure when we distributed a new copies of the presentation this morning, because we discovered that in fact the figure in the narrative and in the presentation were not the same. So the actual figure is 2.77.2 million. We apologize for that, Honourable Member. I think the questions that have been raised by Honourable Banga with regards to the audit reports, by and large, the Deputy Minister has dealt with. On the matter regarding what kind of engagements are being held with different institutions of our criminal justice system, including the National Prosecuting Authority. Perhaps Mr. Zabidi will also give us some updates. But what has been happening is that there is a team called the Anti-Corruption Task Team in government, which brings together the National Prosecuting Authority, police, SARS, the HOT, and many others. And each one, of course, has a different value add to the work that's been done. And there have been consistent engagements with the Anti-Corruption Task Team to mobilize all resources within the state to make sure that cases that have been investigated, and we believe there may well be sufficient evidence on the basis of which the National Prosecuting Authority may be in a position to make a decision whether or not to prosecute, that the National Prosecuting Authority must in fact to be able to make those kinds of decisions. So the nature of the engagement is that where some evidence from forensic reports and other evidence that may well have been gathered in the course of criminal investigation have been placed before the National Prosecuting Authority, we've requested them to give us sense of whether or not, in fact, based on what they have, whether it is possible for them to take a decision whether or not to prosecute, so that we know what cases are likely to be prosecuted. But remember, even when a decision to prosecute is taken, it doesn't necessarily mean that a conviction is necessarily guaranteed, because it will still depend on the evidence as it is tested under cross-examination and the like, as to whether or not there is evidence on the basis of which competent courts can convict. On matters relating to the SIU and the proclamations, I'm speaking under correction here. The SIU requires a presidential proclamation for them to investigate, and I think that's how their act is actually structured. What I'm not certain about, and it's information we can gather, not unless the Deputy Minister is able to assist me. We would request the SIU to commission an investigation on matters that pertain to our immediate sphere of influence. But in instances where something is happening in a municipality, where you also have an executive authority in the context of the municipality, I'm not certain whether it is the minister that requests the proclamation at the end, or it is in fact either the NEC, the specific province, or the municipality itself. That request that. But I know that Mr. Sigiri is also dealing with matters of the anti-corruption work, and he might be able to step in and assist me there. On the other questions, I think the Deputy Minister has dealt with measures quite exhaustively. On the issues relating to mega expenditure monitoring, we are certainly going in the direction of making our websites user-friendly, in line with the commitment that the Minister made at the meeting 2 weeks ago, in response to the question that was raised by Honourable Member Milliham. We are taking stock of improvements that we are going to make to our website, and certainly we would like it to be more than just a website, but a true portal of information on a whole range of things, which will provide links to municipalities and a whole range of other entities that play a very important role in the local space. Certainly the kind of information you're referring to, such as maid monitoring, the kind of information we should be able to find, you know, on the portal that we are putting together. Thank you very much.
Thank you, DG. Perhaps on the question of equitable share review, when the equitable share was reviewed in 2012 and the formula was adopted in the budget forum in 2013 for implementation, for two components, which is the community service component and the institutional component, we will look at two areas, the base allocation as well as the additional fund based on the council size. So there is already a differentiation that is dealt with there. But on the issue of the basic services, which is mainly relating to the population size, what we are doing is that on an annual basis, the formula is updated on account of two reasons. One is the one that the DG has mentioned in terms of the growth in household numbers, and the second one is updating the cost of providing basic services, incorporating focusing on the CPI inflation and annual tariff increases in the cost for water and electricity. So on an annual basis, the formula is updated in that regard. Now, with regard to the question on why Renosterberg was singled out, Honorable Member, I don't have the details of those other two municipalities. I will request that perhaps I come back and review the correct information. On the question of the ESCOM meeting, what was the outcome of the ESCOM meeting? Like the Honorable Member said, the very issues that were there, you mentioned the two of them, the 15 days issue that we were fighting for and the issue of Prime Plus 5. There was a third issue, which was the issue around the notified maximum demand, the penalties there. ESCOM could not really budge on those issues. And then we then decided that it would be difficult for us to be dealing with ESCOM because we have written to ESCOM twice. And the response was that they are still going to stick to the 15 days and the time plus 5. And we decided that we should deal with the shareholder rather than with ESCOM. We have written to the Department of Public Enterprise. And in our letter, we're just requesting to get an understanding of perhaps the policy framework that they are using when they bring in the 15 days period rather than the 30-day period and the issue of the time plus 5. We didn't touch the issue of the notified maximum demands because we are saying that is the issue that we thought it should form part of the package that will require some form of policy direction, because the depending on whether the municipality is given an allocation of, for instance, 50 megawatt hours used per month, if they exceed that notified maximum demand, let's say they're given 5 kilowatt hour as the notified maximum demand, if they exceed it in 1 month, they're charged penalties for the full year. So that we are saying is still a matter that is still under discussion. The issue around municipalities that are owed billions by a government department, except the issues that the DG has indicated in terms of our engagement with public works and the service provider was mostly dealing with the pre-devolution cases. In the current cases, we've got two actions that happened. One is that the Director General of Treasury has written to national departments and provincial departments, indicate to them that they need to pay their dues, and if not, the action that is currently being employed in municipalities will be employed to those departments. The second area, I think the DG, if you was here, he will talk to it. We have said that some of the challenges that national and provincial departments are saying is that there are these invoices that where they are really saying they are not necessarily correct. There is a decision that has been taken in the PCC that if you are clearing a deal from a municipality, pay 80% of it, and deal with the asset and verify. After verification, if you realize that you have paid more, then it will be credited to you at a later stage. So those are some of the actions that have been looked at. Now, with regard to Honorable Banga on the issues of the interactions with all the law enforcement agencies, The interaction that we are having with the law enforcement agencies starts at the level of the anti-corruption touching, but then there are various institutions that we refer various cases to. For instance, when we were assessing the 115 cases that we had received, we were saying some of these cases are criminal cases, then you need the DCCI to really come into the party. And then we say, let's also assess those cases where there could be a possibility of asset forfeiture. So that is why you'll find that we indicate that so many cases have been referred, and there is room for asset forfeiture on those. And those nine that we have referred to the FIU, it depends. When you look at it, you might say, is this a case that really we can be able to see whether there is a crime-related activity? And then we need the SIU to really go and confirm, and then we deal with the outcome. The other issue broadly to deal with the work of anti-corruption, we have adopted, not necessarily adopted, we have a draft anti-corruption strategy which is looking at the four areas. The area of prevention, which is where we have as the department, we can be able to deal with issues of prevention. There are issues around detection, and there are issues around the investigation where we bring in all these other law enforcement agencies. Now, the biggest challenge is on the resolution side, because like Honorable Milan has said, when you have an investigation report in a municipality, you expect that the council will resolve on what should happen on the recommendations. But in most cases, you find in most of the municipalities that I've engaged with in the last 2 months when I came to the unit of anti-corruption, when you go and check the council resolution, it says the report has been noted. Now, that is why when we said the report is noted, we are left with an option of saying, let's write to the MECs so that they can put perhaps get more details around the case and investigate where investigation is required. So that is in concluding some of the things that I thought they may require responding to. But perhaps the one issue that one may need to say around the issue of debt. If you look at the September Section 21 report, municipalities are owed 4.8 billion. But if you look at that 4.8 billion carefully, you find that 3.7 is over 90 days. Now the current debt is 684, and that is the one that they say is collectible. But we came to a resolution that government departments, irrespective of whether the debt is over 90 days, they need to be able to pay that particular debt. So that is just some information related to the 4.8 billion that is owed to.
Thanks, and to the honourable members. The cost, as estimated there, were based on an analysis that was done by the team comprised of FHC, Powergard, Treasury, and DCOG. And there's acknowledgement that there are going to be a bit of variations. But looking at the cost that is going to take for each of the measures, it was then averaged around that figure. And what's happening now is that in terms of the province, there's work now that's happening to be detailed costing in terms of how much it's going to cost. And in instances where there's going to be more, like the example that honourable member was giving, I think that we might then have to go back. But an analysis that was done indicates that on average, that's what it's going to cost in terms of the demarcation.
Thank you, Chairperson. Two questions to answer from my side. There was a question about the status and effectiveness of MESA's internal audit function. It is established. The head of internal audit, Jose Castesius here, who put up a hand, she's our director for internal audit. It is functioning. We do have an audit plan, internal audit plan, and in the implementation of the internal audit plan is monitored by MESA's independent audit committee. The internal audit carries out a lot of audits on various areas, and as I mentioned earlier, we have submitted to the committee our post-audit action plan part, which also addresses the audits done by the internal audit units. There was also a question on a comment which we agree with absolutely, that it's very important for NISA to focus on putting in place improved systems, management systems, and that is a major focus of ours in terms of this post-audit action plan. For example, we're putting in place improved systems to pay the players within 30 days, improved control systems over the trainees to monitor them and make sure that we only pay them while they're still working in their municipalities. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for the answers and all of the members.
Just one that I misheard you on, please.
All of you. 1-1-1-1-1. Okay. Let me check my line.
Thank you, Chair. My first one, and I think the DG and Mr. Shididi misunderstood me. When I was talking about the calculation of local government equity share, I mentioned specifically the non-financial census of municipalities. It is an annual census conducted by Statistics South Africa, and it looks specifically at the delivery of municipal services to households. So it gives us a research-based baseline every year that we can then use for calculating what the needs of that municipality are. And I haven't heard anything here that says that we are considering that research. My second issue goes to the transition grant, and I thank the various inputs. I disagree a little bit with Deputy Minister Nelda, because we know that 34 requests were put in. Now, you don't go into a MinMet and say, I want to do this, if you haven't got a plan on how you're going to pay for it. You don't go and say, I'm going to launch this program, if you haven't got a plan in place at that point on how you're going to pay for it. So by that time, there should already have been some idea of the costing. So there were 34 requests that were made by the NDB. Now, I have a little bit of a problem here, because I count 34 requests on 2.9 in your narrative report. I then go down to 2.12, and there are 13 that are mentioned there. And under 3.2, it talks of 21 mergers. So I'm a little bit at odds and ends as to where the different numbers come from. But be that as it may, if there were 34 requests at 17.2 million rand per merger, you'd know that you'd have to budget 584.8 million. Because that's what you calculated is needed, on average. So it's not a difficult calculation I'm talking about. And if you don't spend, you can say, we didn't need it, we didn't have to utilize it, whatever. Or you adjust your budget in the outer years. But as it stands here, it doesn't look like the department has properly thought through the cost of amalgamation, the cost of this transition. And that's my concern, that it's been rushed, and at the last minute they say, oh, we need money. And now there's a shortfall of 227 million that has to be found.
Thanks, sir. I was hoping to, for the issue that the DM raised, if I could come in and come back, sir.
And I thought of some of these issues, the events that correspond, but did you, in the situation when, for instance, we have municipalities, I don't think it's enough for us, and I think, I don't know whether it lies to you that kind of a decision, to say municipalities commission this from the court. I come from a city where the commission, like, for the court, as the commissioner, has never done anything about them. Until we raise this issue of the forensic audit, until we raised it last year. Now, it's not enough to say, Mr. City, there's a gap today. Yes, they do this in sport because they don't want to investigate themselves. Because they're implicated. The same people who have to be investigated are implicated. They're not going to commission them. And to go and, I know of a mayor that was implicated in one, which is Bugan also. There's no way that until the information is decided, everything for 10 years now, 10 to 15 years. Because they keep them there, the information goes and disappears. Now, it's not enough that the department is going to say, there is a limitation, and cannot tell us that we're doing something about it, and when are we going to have a framework to deal with that aspect. And I want to answer, whether are you working to an arrangement into that? If you are, then I'm going to see a framework that begins to guide that to take action. Because I like to see that there must be action in that respect. The second aspect of this question, there are municipalities who did not commission, others who might not commission because of this debate that they don't want to investigate themselves, they're not commissioning anything. What are we going to do? Are we doing something about those to go ahead better? Will we in future, Mr. CC, get a comprehensive report of a detail to say, for instance, Nelson Mandela, we have submitted the ICTX website and submitted a certain report. Well, I want to see this report that are submitted. And we can we get that list of the NCC. That in this respect, these are the current reports that have been submitted and we've seen them, because we have to see them. To raise a very important issue, which I agree with you also in this aspect, because I want to ask what are you going to do about it? Because they're not answer. In Grimstown, when they're in Grimstown, a municipal manager tells us when they have a situation of liquidation,
they were liquidated as a municipality and so on. We asked them, I don't know whether it's assistance as that guy that, did you guide the council that it must not take this time? The municipal manager said, yes, we guided the council. What action have you taken in order for the people who took that decision, for them to pay back the money, to pay back the money, or to claim the money? The municipal manager said, we're still looking for options. Now, I know most, we're going to look for options until Jesus Christ comes back. Because the very same people who must repay the money, they are not going to approve it for the money to be repaid. And what action are going to take? I want to ask specifically, I'm not going to brag about it. Grandstand, we know the level of liquidation that are there, and the guns delivered by people who do not want to listen to the administration. What are we going to do with speech in terms of Grandstand that those people who continue to take those illegal decisions and those officials give them proper legal guidance, what are we going to do about it in Grandstand and where? Thank you.
I just wanted to speak to this minister, particularly this is with myself, and the issue of the transition grants and what the undue influence which has been referred to by the minister to say. The question does not speak to that. I was not suggesting in any way to what I want that for the record to say. I'm not passing any aspersions. On the minister. If I've got any political issues with them, I will raise them in a proper manner, so it's not casting any doubt about it. The point remains that I still feel that the timing of the revoke of Section 22 had a ripple effect which was not favorable in terms of the budgeting for that department. So it was just on that particular aspect. Secondly, on that one, I asked of the total of transitional grant, what was the short term, medium term, and long term branches which were being looked at as the department tries to get the money and for that. Chair, on the narrative report, I was just speaking to the cost of the transitional municipalities, item 2.5 in respect of KZN, I see that Vulamas and Mtoni. I would imagine that a change should be added there because sessions of Umtoni will be going to it. I mean, of Vulamas will be going to Echewini. So it's just a correction, a change. Other question, in Zimbabwe, I'm not sure how far the MDB is because they made an announcement following the problems that in Chulame that we had earlier on. Has been established there. Whether that is going on, if it is, has it been factored into what is here, the state of the new municipality there in that, So my final point is just really a comment, it's a concern more than anything else. Municipalities, as far as I'm concerned, find themselves at the receiving end of what I would want to call bullying. On one hand, if they do not serve their debt, they've got issues with Tesla, so or somebody somewhere going to withhold money. On the other hand, you've got other provincial and national departments owing municipalities money. What happens to those municipalities? I think we must arrive at a point where we treat municipalities with the respect that they deserve as a sphere of government. I think that everybody else, we are doing a church carefully hamburger sort of approach to saying, oh, we are going to make arrangements 80% and we'll negotiate. Who's negotiating for himself? I really feel that we are doing disservice to an extent to the full functionality of municipalities in the manner in which the issue of their creditors and debtors is being handled. And I would plead that that's presumed into looked at to ensure which is, because they're not at the receiving end of problems. Because particularly provincial governments, they are gone rogue. They run away from provincial government. Here, with the government, national departments, they are being hauled before everybody. Municipalities, I find that provincial governments, their cooperation, they make a major problem. And
municipalities are seen to be the little kid that anybody can raffle as and how they please. So let us restore the legitimacy of municipalities in every respect as a sphere of government. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you. You can comment all of your issues on the issues that are raised by members. I think that's been a while before the deputy minister will have to ask you what you need to do to address some of the issues. Did you know anything that's going to come?
Yes, I'm going to ask Mr. Spirit to deal with the special matters that have been raised. And he's ready to. Really.
Yes, but thank you, DG. I think the follow-up that has been raised by Honorable Miriam, yes, we might have misunderstood because we're just indicating that on an annual basis we are using estimates. What we'll do, engage with Treasury because we do look at these things annually. We'll engage with Treasury and the State South Africa to look at the real figures and then we'll be adjusting the formula accordingly. Thanks.
Thanks for the comment on the Etokuni one. We'll get it an update. On the one in Popo, it's captured under the comment on the table 2.12, under the comment where we're indicating that there will not be a reduction and so on. The last part of the sentence is cut off from our current Lamela Incorporated to form a new municipality. So that's how we've actually just said that.
Thank you very much. I think we have traversed the foreseeability issue. So I don't want to dwell on that, other than to just say again, remember Section 22 notices were published in January of 2015. The budget was tabled in February of 2015. So, yeah. Had the process commenced earlier and there's been an opportunity to make proposals with regard to the budget, I'm sure we would have considered that, but ultimately there was no way for us to quantify the exact amount needed until such time as the board had independently made it up its mind and come to its determinations. Secondly, with regard to the Honourable Senghwa, I think we associate ourselves wholeheartedly with the very impassioned plea that you made for all and sundry to respect municipalities, including the payment of what is due to municipalities. And I think both DG Madonsela and Mr. Speedy have outlined the steps that we are taking. And I think no doubt we'll engage with National Treasury to expedite. I think DG Madonsela omitted in his reply to mention the fact that this matter was put on the agenda of the forum of South African Directors General, and I think the Riot Act was led to the accounting officers of our national departments. But it's something that we would continue to work on. But having said that, I think also that this requires a broader debate. The issue of intergovernmental debt is a very serious one, and because we are in government and have a direct power to influence that, we believe we need to act and we need to
to act decisively on that matter. But let us not forget that the vast bulk of the debt owed to municipalities is non-state debt. And within that, there are considerable amounts owed by business. And I think we need to encourage a general culture of payment towards municipalities and the services. And that would apply also to those big commercial concerns who act in a out-and-out corrupt manner to suborn officials within municipalities to either connect them illegally or to connect them on terms far below what they should be paying, costing the municipality and ultimately the taxpayer hundreds of millions of rand. So I think it's also an area that we should speak loudly on. I think lastly, and this is not in any way to deflect from the importance of national and provincial governments to pay what they owe municipalities, but I think just for the accuracy of the debate, we must bear in mind that, and Mr. Segidi can correct me if I'm wrong, but the studies we've done do not show a one-to-one correlation between monies owed by national and provincial departments to municipalities and what municipalities owe to ESCOM and to the water boards. So what I'm saying is the fact that a national department might be owing Magaung a certain amount does not necessarily translate. Magaung might be quite up to date in paying ESCOM and the water boards. Could be another municipality that might not be owed anything by a national or a... I think it's just, again, not to deflect from the importance, but if we're going to have a rigorous discussion, we should be clear on those facts. But on Busenga, as I said, I can only agree with you on the appeal that you've made. Thanks.
DG, another point? DG, you're fine?
I hear Honorable Bane is worried about his question, which I thought might be a question that perhaps the Deputy Minister could have had. The issue that of saying what are we going to do if the council has taken an illegal decision, which illegal decision might be involved in perhaps financial implications. At the moment, I don't have the correct answer for that question. What I wanted to say about that is that there is this issue about the responsibilities of an accounting officer against the executing authority. And from where I'm sitting, the council is the executing authority and the municipal manager is the accounting officer, so he accounts on the money. Now, it boils down to the last step of your anti-corruption, your resolution aspect, which deals with this. How do you deal with the loss of recovery? If the municipality has lost money due to a particular decision, firstly, you need to investigate as the accounting officer to get to the extent of that particular loss, and then take action in terms of recovery. But I know that it's a very difficult thing to do. I can't, fortunately, I'm not an accounting officer, but the DG can assist with this one. If you have to be taking money from your political principal, how do you deal with it? So I just thought this is something that is very difficult for me to really respond to.
Sorry, Chair. I've asked these questions two. There's a legal framework here. The committee will ask, I'm not going to deal with this issue because I wanted to make an example with one. As a broader issue,
we have a situation as we speak now, it runs down. We have requested in Makana, we have requested, it's not once it runs down, just because the lawyer litigations. We have not won. The municipal manager confirms to Bomiji. I ask the personnel, did you advise them according to the decision the KGS? We advise them, they did not want to take our decision. Then the committee says, give us a report on this, on the options that we're going to take in terms of recovering the money. I know, Minister, that is not going to come because the municipal manager, the accounting officer, has explained. But we want to know the department in apply the law of the country. When are we going to claim to that municipality to continue to take illegal decisions on behalf of the council, specifically Grahamstown, Makana, because we should make an example with the case that the municipal manager have confirmed in front of the committee. That's the first aspect. The second aspect is the framework. We know that they have confirmed that part of the limitation is that council does not use the court. Now, we can leave it there. According to the executive, what plans are you putting in coming out with a framework for us to deal with that limitation? And if there's no plans, if there are plans, how long can we expect as committee that framework for us to be able to deal with the limitation in which the officials have raised? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Just on the last question, I think this is what we've reported. We've said that in terms of the back to basics approach, the issue of combating fraud and corruption is central. It touched upon by more than one pillar of the five back to basics pillars. It deals with issues of sound financial management, good governance, and building strong institutions. In furtherance of the back to basics approach, one of the things, and I stress one, not only one, has been to take very real concerted action on the bad tendency of forensic reports being commissioned, being tabled, and then no action being taken. That is why the National Department of COPPA is now sitting in possession of more than 100 of those forensic reports, so that we ourselves, together with the relevant law enforcement agencies, can analyze those reports and request the provinces concerned to follow up and to ensure that action is taken, the recommended action is taken. Now, as Mr. Shigidi and the DG pointed out, in some cases, the recommended action might be further investigation. So we need to make sure that that happens. But where there's a clear-cut recommendation of either disciplinary action to be taken or criminal charges to be instituted, that is what we are ensuring happens. As I said, that is one pillar of work taken place. With regard to your first question, and DG could, as an accounting officer himself, elaborate, the fact of the matter is that the work of our municipalities is governed by the Constitution and the applicable law, which in this case would be the Municipal Finance Management Act. It is illegal for an accounting officer to implement an illegal decision or instruction. Now, that's not to negate the very real difficulties that accounting officers and other officials might find themselves in that situation, and our duty to support them to do and to continue doing the right thing. But I think, as far as the law is concerned, it's abundantly clear. The DD might want to add on that. Thanks.
Thank you, dear Mike. I really don't have much to add. I'm in my 30 years now as a DG, I've never found myself in that situation where I was forced to consider granting approval to an illegal kind of decision. But if it were to happen, the law actually gives the accounting officer original powers. What's important to appreciate is the fact that accounting officers
are not delegated the responsibilities that they are expected to exercise in terms of the Public Finance Management Act or the Ministry of Finance Management Act. They actually have original powers. So that makes the accounting officer, in that sense, a very powerful office. The office is a very powerful one. Because this person is entrusted with a very important responsibility. So, as the Deputy Minister points out, in those instances where a municipal manager is faced with having to deal with the fact that despite the correct advice they have given to the principals, they have nonetheless decided to go the other way. I think that we need to consider. If, for an example, and it will also depend on what kind of decision that is, the detail of it is important. If, for an example, there is a commitment made to a head party, even if it's done illegally, a commitment is made to a head party who renders a service, there's still an obligation, by the way, to pay for that service, as long as you are able to show that that service has been rendered. But then you have the obligation to recover wasted costs from those who are responsible for it. And which is the point that Mr. Gidu, who fortunately for him was an accounting officer in the municipality before, in a more direct kind of space. I think it's a very delicate situation for an accounting officer to find themselves in. It does certainly require that we examine whether there are extra measures we need to think about to help accounting officers to do as they're required to do by law, to recover those monies from principals. In fact, the other question that you had raised, and I hope I didn't misunderstand it, had to do with let me see, I thought about the answer to the question you posed, and I hope I understood it correctly. But at present, the minister is required in terms of Section 106 to request the NEC, say, to commission an investigation or take certain action in respect of something that might be happening in the municipality. But the law at present says the minister can't do anything beyond that until 90 days has expired. If the AC that's been requested doesn't do anything, only after 90 days. And part of what they are looking to revamp is to shorten that period. That you don't have to wait for 90 days before an AC either acts or not acts in respect of a request made to them. That we're looking at shortening that period. Because I recall that we're looking at about 30 days. Okay. We were looking at shortening that period to make sure that it doesn't take that long before the minister can actually step in. So those are some of the measures we are thinking of to make sure that we strengthen the entire dispensation, to make sure that the minister is also enabled by legislation to step in as quickly as possible. But at present, until 90 days has expired, after the NEC has been requested, all we can do is to follow up with the NEC to get reports. And only after 90 days, if NEC is found not to have acted upon the request, can the minister then intervene in the municipality directly by way of commission and investigation matters of that kind. Thanks.
There was one question that I missed on the tranches. So in terms of 139 million that we have over the MTF period, 39 million is available for the current financial year 15-16 and 50-50 for the outer year. Thanks.
Okay, so thank you very much for this, and a very useful report for us. I think I'm very happy now. I know that you want to pay councillor. And if you become a councillor, you must know how you're going to hold you accountable. It's going to be difficult for you. It's nice to hold others accountable. I think once you hold you accountable, you will really feel it. Let alone in Nelson Mandela, where you are going to. If you become a councillor, though, my advice that remain here as far as I hear them. Say what you are fine. Okay, you tell you are fine. Now, exhausted, I know that you are not well.
No, because I think the report has been presented to us and we pose many questions. I think the department is really capturing every matter that we have raised in terms of our last PRR process. I guess we should do that for all departments, I guess, all departments do what they are doing here. To find out whether really the decision taken by the HMO is respected by everyone. But we are those who account to the House and those who are members of the chamber, ministers and members of parliament. Generally, they wouldn't take decisions that themselves they would not be able to ensure that the administration implement them. And I think it's very useful for us, for Mr. Dr. Fields, I think is assisting us. The report is very clear what we are doing to address some of the weaknesses of MISA for some time. The department, I think, is on track. And of course, you know that you received unqualified reports, some matter here and there. Anyway, that I heard of this, what is called clean audit. I never understood what does it mean, truly speaking, but I love this now. I'm not sure what does it mean, really. But I know same way another member of the public account now, when they go to the chamber, talk about clean audit, who can think that they're in New Jerusalem. And then in the New Jerusalem. And the understanding of the clean audit is very sharp in our search. And we hope that we'll be able to reach that stage at a certain point in time. But I think we are ahead with Miss because he has been our problematic child for some time. And I think they are putting their house in order. Dr. Phillips is here. I think we're doing well. Surely in our next financial year, we'll be able again to have discussion. Thank you, Deputy Minister, for staying with us in the meeting. And thank you for Honorable Cadell and the Minister. And we hope that we'll be able then to meet to deal with some of the issues. We are mindful that we have presented the bill yesterday on the traditional leadership and question view. It's before us now as members of parliament. We have to look at it and find out the challenges and how do we do it. When I was young, I thought that there are no traditional leaders in some provinces. It seems all provinces suddenly put traditional leaders. In Johannesburg, the traditional leader, I never knew of that. It's very clear that we are modernizing our country by going back to feudalism. It's fine. it's a good way of doing things. It's a unique South African way of doing things. You must appreciate it. And we are facing this situation. We have to address it with the support of the department. Sorry, support of the leadership here. I think we'll be able to deliver on the bill. It has raised a lot of interest. Director General and your colleague, Dr. Mwale. A lot of interest in many research organizations. But also, there's a lot of interest in the women's research centers. And then I think ourselves must be well prepared, politically and otherwise, to convince the female colleagues who are raising real objection on some of the issues. For various reasons, really. Anger, I was raising some objection because he thought that you are promoting a very backward system. Instead of going past the 21st century, going to the 16th century. And he's raising some of those issues. We hope that he will assist us also in Mutani. That we are no longer having those problems there. It's a challenge that we are facing. It's going to take some time and effort from our side. With the local government elections coming, it seems that the committee is going to be very busy on some of the issues there. And we are happy to report, and we are going to have some discussion on that. There are new issues that we find in our report, of course. We'll write them down, and then we forward it to the DG, to the minister, if we need some answers. And then we'll meet Tuesdays and Wednesdays if need be. We don't want to exhaust members of parliament. They must go and do constituency work. That's when there's need, of course, to meet Wednesdays then I think the department will always be available when it's requested to appear before the committee to assist us with some information. And I thank you very much, Chris. I think you have exhausted all the questions. I think the committee is ready to behave with the progress made by the department. And there was the spirit that's always prevailed when we engage in. When it started, it was a very rowdy meeting. But more and more, we're becoming a 21st century gentleman. And ladies, as soon as we're engaging now, on ideas, really, we're not more personal in addressing some of the challenges identified for us. Thank you very much, colleagues. We meet at a plenary at 3.
Thank you.